All right, hi everybody, and welcome to our test 2 preparation class for the junior and senior high in the ancient history program of History at Our House. We are going to go over the junior high test preparation sheets momentarily here. Just let me briefly address a small problem on the class webpage. The History Through Art link was not posted and then incorrectly posted. Wow, I compounded one error with another. And so it's now there and correct. And so the way to make sure that it's correct is if you see the wording updated link, that will mean that you have the latest refreshed page, okay? So if you don't see that, then you need to refresh the page. And so that you're not using a buffered page, as you might know, in browsers, you don't always get the absolute latest unless you demand it by pressing refresh. Okay? So once you see updated link, you'll get the right one. Okay? And so now we go to the test preparation sheet. And so we'll go over your answers to that. And then any follow-up and other types of questions you may have, and we'll be ready for the test this weekend. Okay, so slightly modified version of the timeline, right, with a few extra milestones and a little bit, in some cases, extra information to guide you. So I guess I put down certain milestones as they related to events that you might be curious, because we didn't do all of these as a facts practice leading up to the test. We're going to do them as facts practice after the test, but you might be looking at those wondering what they were. So I put the dates when it wasn't certain. So write a brief description of the key event indicated on the Anchor Fact timeline, including the date if it occurred. The date occurred if it is not given, right? So what I want here in many cases is for you to kind of think of history in this way and to kind of automatize the model. And so I won't always necessarily give you the date. And so, for instance, blue, of course, is the United States and things like that. So that's your kind of your responsibility to be able to figure that out. And soon enough, you'll be asked to, you'll be given a blank sheet and you'll be asked to create the Anchor Fact timeline from scratch. So that'll be the higher level exercise that I will be asking of you. But anyway, starting with number one, because it is the correct place to start whenever any thinking occurs in history. So Nemo, go ahead.
I am here. Study the past to better understand the present.
Okay, nicely done. I like the way you formulated that. I think there's a lot of ways that could be said, but that's what I want to see. Not just I am here, which is good, but, what is the point, right? In this context, the point is we study the past because it brought us to the present, where we are. Okay, and there's a lot of different ways to say that. So, any other formulations? Rosie?
I am here in 2015, and this is where we are in history.
Okay, I like that. See, that's another way of putting it. This is where we are in history. So that gives you then the context to reach back and find out about history. Okay, most important fact about history, number two. Theo, go ahead.
In 1776 AD, a group of British colonists we know as the Founding Fathers created the USA.
Okay, so that is definitely the thing that we need there. Maybe don't have to be quite so wordy. You could just say the Founding Fathers created the United States by the Declaration of Independence, or gave birth to the United States by issuing the Declaration of Independence. And so that definitely is crucial to, again, anchoring all of our studies. Because whenever we go into the past, we do so from where we are, and that is an America-centric, globalized, interconnected world. That's what this black line here represents, by the way, if you hadn't asked me, or if I can't remember how much I've elaborated on this. The any line that goes from one, you know, horizontal line to another is a what? Is a symbol of a what? And we got a big, we got one here. We got one here, and we got one here. We got three big vertical lines in our Angkorvac timeline of world history. What are the vertical lines, folks? Keen?
Connections,
right, okay. So there's a connection here, right, between America and Europe. The discovery of America by Columbus creates a connection. There's a huge wave of connections here by European civilization in its colonization and imperialism later on in history that connects all of the parts of the world together. And this is an expression of that, which just says the present that we live in is globally interconnected. Okay, all of it is connected. Most of what's in your house was manufactured in China, right? And that's over here. You're over here, but yeah, that's over here, right? And the war on terror and ISIS and all of those headaches in the world, that has to do with this part of the world, even though we're over here. And so on. So it's all connected. Okay, so continuing here. So number two, we've got Declaration of Independence. Number three on this timeline is Cliff.
Christopher Columbus discovered...
You missed it. Whoopsie. That would be over here if it was number three. That's this connection here. Want to do it again?
Sorry. I'm going to have to go back over that.
Okay. What about from gray to green? What's that? The lines are not quite in the right place, I just noticed. I got to change this around a little bit. But can't get off the top of your head, Cliff?
No, sorry.
All right. You need more facts practicing. All right, somebody else, please. From gray to green. Where are all the hands up here? I don't see enough hands up. Nemo?
America became a republic after its birth.
What? Number three. Not number two. Number two is the blue over here. That's America. Green is Europe. Gray is the ancient world. Try it again, Nemo.
Three is the discovery of America.
Oh, no. Wait a minute. What's going on? You guys are really confused about this, are you? That would be a connection between Europe and America, which is over here. That's this one. All right. I mean, I thought on the test one preparation that we had it like that, and you could easily look at that and your facts practices, and you'd be able to decipher which one it is that I'm asking for. But I guess this has kind of thrown you guys a little bit here. Rosie, what do you have?
The Dark Ages.
Well, begin because of?
The fall of Rome.
When?
I can't remember the date.
Oh my gosh. Alrighty-dighty. So you guys have completely forgotten all your anchor facts. So that is an interesting thing because I neglected to maintain the facts practice on the premise that it was pretty solid. But evidently, it's actually pretty shaky. So, I'm glad because now I will be more aggressive about making sure that you are familiar with this construct and what the milestones are. This is an anchor fact of ancient history. Because over here we have Jesus, and over here we have the Rome and Athens. This is the ancient world of Greece and Rome that we're going to be studying now, and the Dark Ages follow the fall of Rome, and then in the Renaissance we get the discovery of America, and so on, right? So Nemo says, well, I knew it, but you didn't put the dates. Well, I know, but that's part of kind of challenging you here to think it through. The colors, I gave you all the colors, I didn't make it all gray. So, you know, we've done this as a facts practice multiple times. I thought I had given you enough information. This obviously is Egypt and Mesopotamia. This is Islam. All right. This is India and China and Russia and Europe and America. This is ancient Greece and Rome. So, Cliff doesn't have colored ink in his printer. He must live in some kind of archaic place, Cliff. Color printers are about $60 nowadays. So, I don't know. All right. Sorry for that. All right, fall of Rome. An anchor fact, right? Because we don't live in the ancient world anymore. Right? We don't live in the ancient world anymore. So, that's a really crucial fact. Because we live over here, and we are separated from all of this stuff because Rome fell. So we got to establish that connection. And that connection for us flows through Europe. Okay, that's what this is all about. Alrighty. Well, number four, notice that I put it in purple, is a revival of something which had been suppressed, right? Something which was largely forgotten and disappeared. So that one is, at least, I put a date on that one, right? On some of them I put dates, and some I didn't. Sophie, go ahead.
King Tut's intact tomb is found in Upper Egypt in the Valley of the Kings by Howard Carter.
Okay, right. And why is that an anchor fact, Sophie?
Because it awakened people's sense of ancient Egypt, because it had been dampened because they couldn't find any more tombs and they couldn't do any more research on it.
Yeah, I mean, it sparked a new interest in Egypt, right? Okay, the pyramids have been there forever. We've been looking at those for quite a while. The green line over here is our Champollion and our Napoleon and our Rosetta Stone, right? And so that was the initial spark to Egyptology. But, okay, and our connection to Egypt begins with that. But later on, we get a kind of 100 years later, we get a new, exciting development that gets us interested in other parts of Egypt, right? Because, you know, the pyramids, well, they take us back to the age of pyramids. But King Tut wasn't buried in a pyramid, right? This is a whole other phase of Egypt. How do we get connected to that phase? Well, we might not be connected to it. We might not be any more interested in the pharaohs of Egypt than the kings of Assyria. I didn't tell you the names of any of the kings of Assyria. Why? Because they don't matter. Sorry, my former Assyrian, kings and so on. You guys were really, really brutal. And there are things that I know about you that I wouldn't even tell my students. But I'm not going to mention your names because it's not important. On the other hand, we have this connection to the later history of Egypt because of King Tut. So that's an anchor fact. Rosie, go ahead.
I
see. All right, let's continue on. Number five. The interruption of the archaic past and its substitution by something else. Theo.
Islam is created in circa 622 AD, going on to become one of the largest and most successful religions in the world.
Okay, right. And basically, the basis of an entire cultural block in the world, right? The Islamic world, stretching across northern Africa through the Middle East and all the way to Indonesia, right, is a massive cultural block. And that cultural block has blocked our access to the archaic world to quite a considerable extent. But despite that, European archaeologists in particular have been able to penetrate to the archaic past and learn about it. All right, so 622 AD. Then, well, you got two dated ones here because I wanted to help you find the spot in the notes since we hadn't reviewed these ones before. I thought these earlier ones here, we'd seen them so many times, you would have known them. These ones, I gave you the dates. So, circa 1700 AD, Nemo.
The Code of Hammurabi.
Okay. Is created. And so what? Okay, I want a brief description here. I want it to be an anchor fact. So a fact by itself is not really going to cut it, right? That is a dead end to just enunciate facts. It should be BC. Somebody noticed that it's supposed to be BC. Good one. My goodness. See, people are supposed to email me these things and tell me about my typos. But, so I don't get enough help from everybody else out there about typos. So anyway, BC, obviously you guys can get over that mistake. But let's get the anchor fact for Hammurabi. So, Abby?
Well, the importance of the Code of Hammurabi was that it helps us walk around now, knowing that we don't have such a brutally cruel form of ruling.
Mm-hmm, right, okay. So it connects, so that's a part of it, but that's actually what comes kind of second. In other words, what you're talking about is what the Code of Hammurabi does for us concerning the present. What we want is how it connects us here in the present to the past. Notice it's a little bit of a different take, right? So in other words, what it does for us in that capacity is it shows us what the archaic world was like. It connects us to that archaic world. And then, as you say, by comparison then, we can really much more deeply appreciate the progress that has been made since then in developing more humane right laws based on individual rights. So that's the next step along that path, Abby. But the first thing that it does is it connects us here in the present to an archaic past and to the way that society was organized back then in the absence of all of this progress, of all of these better things that have happened since. So otherwise, you know, what would we know about them? Otherwise, what would we know about this archaic past? We wouldn't feel any connection. Wouldn't feel any connection. Okay, so number 7, 2500 BC. So, let's see. Theo, go ahead.
Pharaoh Khufu built an enormous pyramid at Giza, still here today.
Okay. Right, so you can, since it's circa, you can go a little wider than that. You can say the Egyptian pharaohs construct the pyramid complex at Giza. Right, it's all around that time. Yes, some of it's 2600, some of it's, no, but it's all circa 2500. So the pyramids at Giza are constructed by the Egyptians. Okay, so let's generalize a little bit more. Okay, good. So moving now to more of the heart of the test. So, what gigantic artifacts anchor the study of Egyptian history today? Why are they so useful in the study of an extinct culture like pharaohic Egypt? All right, Sophie, go ahead.
The pyramids are the burial places for the pharaohs of archaic Egypt. Inside the monuments, their culture was preserved with the pharaoh's body. These artifacts are studied today to understand Egypt's place in history.
Okay, that's kind of nice. Read it one more time.
The pyramids are the burial places for the pharaohs of archaic Egypt. Inside the monuments, their culture was preserved with the pharaoh's body. These artifacts are studied today to understand Egypt's place in history.
Okay, the reason why I had to hear it again was it feels like it's a little bit out of order. Okay, in other words, I was waiting for you to answer question number one, and what I found was you more answered the first question at the end And so your answer is, I think, a little bit out of order, right? So you start talking about the tombs of the pharaohs and how that preserved Egyptian culture, and then you kind of wrap it back around to how that connects us to ancient Egypt, which is more kind of the first question. So, I mean, it was a good answer and well, you know, well formulated, but I feel like it needs to be edited in the sense of, you know, reordered in order to kind of answer this a little bit better. Let's have some alternative formulations, please. Rosie, what's yours?
Giant artifacts of Egypt are the pyramids. They are useful to study Egyptian history because they have the stories of the people in Egypt and artifacts about how to study and how they live.
Okay. I think what I would like to see there is that's a kind of a general truth. And with regard to the pyramids, I'd like you to say specifically, how do they, you know, what are the artifacts or how do they, right? They reveal the religious beliefs of the Egyptians, namely that the pharaohs were god kings and who cared for Egypt after death, and that the Egyptian society revolved around the entombment of those pharaohs. Okay, so that's the thing that's why they're so useful, because they show us so much about Egyptian society, namely their religious practices. Timothy.
The pyramids anchor the study of Egyptian history today because they are one of the most important Egyptian artifacts that showed Egyptian life that still lasts to this day. They were extremely hard to build, and it took an extremely long time to build them. And the tallest ones still rank up with the tallest man-made structures to this day.
Okay, right. So that feels like a very abundant answer to the first part of the question, but not so much to the second part. Okay, so again, I feel like you haven't told me yet what they were and why are they so useful, because they reveal the culture of the Egyptians, the religious culture of the Egyptians surrounding the pharaohs and their belief in the afterlife. Okay, so I feel like this answer is one that everybody here so far is making a good contribution to, but we haven't quite nailed it. And so watch out for the parts of the question, the right ordering of those parts, and the completion, right? Don't leave it hanging in generalities. Let's be specific. Okay, let's go to number 9. What did Herodotus say about life in Egypt? Explain what he meant. How did the pharaonic system of government reflect this truth? Nemo, go ahead.
Herodotus called life in Egypt the gift of the Nile. In ancient times, the Nile used to flood every year, bringing in extra nutritious soil and water, which the Egyptians used to grow crops. The Egyptians thought it was literally a gift from the gods, as the Nile provided such a wonderful environment for the Egyptians.
Okay, you didn't get the third part. How did the pharaonic system of government reflect this truth? So watch out, you did a great job on the first two parts, but you missed the third part. Watch out, Mr. Powell is infamous for multi-part questions that require multi-part answers. Theo.
Herodotus said that Egypt was the gift of the Nile, meaning that it would not exist if the Nile was not there to support it. The pharaonic system reflected that this because, in Egyptian belief, the god king controlled the flooding of the all-important Nile, and they needed him to survive.
Say the last part again. I was a little distracted by chatting. Go ahead.
The god king controlled the flooding of the all-important Nile, and they needed him to survive.
Nope. That's not how the pharaonic system of government reflected this truth. That is an interesting answer, because that would be much more a reflection of how the Egyptian priesthood promoted the pharaonic system within the culture. But the truth of the matter is, the religious caste and the government knew full well that they did not control the river. So, what did they have to do? Abby, what's your answer?
Well, Herodotus called Egypt the gift of the Nile, basically saying that Egyptian life was Nilocentric. The pharaonic system of government reflected this because they used a Nilometer to measure the height of the Nile so that they could figure out how much they should tax people.
Okay, there you go. Short and sweet. I mean, it could be nice to elaborate on that a little bit, but that's what I was looking for. Okay, in other words, pharaonic government was calculated to reflect the fact that life in Egypt was Nilocentric. If you wanted to have a so-called, you know, I use this expression, pharaoh-centric society, and you want to be the pharaoh and you want to be at the center, well, guess what? You better acknowledge the actual truth, that is, that life is Nilocentric. Because you can go ahead. Remember how we had that little illustration of who was it? Was it Alfred? What was his name? Was it King Canute? No, it was King Canute who sat on the throne and ordered the tide not to come in. And the tide came in, right? And this was that premise of humility that I wanted to illustrate by contrast to the way that things are done in, you know, things were believed or kind of promoted in Egyptian culture. The premise was that the pharaoh actually did control things, or at least that was, you know, part of the mystique of pharaonic government was some notion of controlling these phenomena. All right, so let me pause for a second here. I'm going to try to see about the noise. I'm going to move to a quieter room. I don't know why there's some noise out front. Guys, sorry about that. So now let's continue here. Number 10. Why is Mentuhotep II a significant ruler in Egyptian history? Sophie, go ahead.
Pharaoh Mentuhotep II again unified Upper and Lower Egypt after Menes' number. Mentuhotep ruled Upper Egypt, but he expanded it to Lower Egypt as well. Mentuhotep also chose to have his burial tomb in Upper Egypt hidden away on a stretch of rock instead of building a large pyramid.
Okay, so, so you've got the two parts here, and that's important. So the part about the reunification of Egypt, we need to highlight that, absolutely. The second part is the construction of a rock-cut tomb, but there's a little missing. What's missing, guys? What's missing? The fact that he built a rock-cut tomb is true. What's missing? King, go ahead.
Sort of what that means about Egypt. I would say what that means is that the age of the pyramids is over and that the God-king construct is not as strong as it was during the age of the pyramids.
There you go. Exactly. See, it's the cultural shift that it represents, the end of that phase of Egyptian history where the pharaohs can build pyramids and want to build pyramids because they really think of themselves in a certain way and they want everybody else to think of themselves in that way. But I don't know if you mentioned it, Sophie. You might have. Your answer was... a lot of components there. Did you mention that he was previously a vizier? I can't remember if you had said that or not, which would be a useful addition there in the sense that in relation to the idea that he's not a god king anymore, right? He's a guy who's taking over by, you know, purely violent means, it's reunification, but reunification is a euphemism, right? Because reunification means lots of people are getting slaughtered in order for one person to take over. That is sadly what it means. So, yeah, and the kind of culture that results doesn't have that same reverence for the pharaohs as before. Or at least, now you can see, you can kind of phrase this different ways, or you could look at it different ways, which is the challenge. And there's, we've got to have a little bit of humility when we're giving our answers here, because we can't know, you know, the souls of the Egyptians. But what I mean by that is, we can't look inside the heart of every Egyptian person, like, you know, in the Book of the Dead, where the heart is weighed against the feather of truth, and know what each one was thinking. Right? So in other words, the reason I bring that up is, do we know if Mentuhotep II was religious or not? Just because he built a different kind of tomb? Was he less religious or more religious? I mean, that is something that we have to infer. That's something that we have to make a judgment about without being able to, you know, connect him to a lie detector test and to ask him 20 questions. So there's, you know, we cannot know, and there's an awful lot of presumption in terms of modern history nowadays with regard to a lot of things that have happened in the past. A presumption of being able to judge people and being able to condemn people and certain things, it's a very strange conduct, because it's amazing when people think they are allowed to, you know, like I said, to pronounce judgment on so completely anachronistically. We have to be humble in the sense that we only know what we know, And so Mentuhotep radically changed the type of architecture that was used in the funeral complex of Egyptian pharaohs. And that was a new trend. So he's not an aberration in the sense that he's not the only guy who thought to do that and then everybody else built pyramids. No, there were no more pyramids. Now you tell me, in a society that was so incredibly focused on pyramids, how could it be that they stopped building them all of a sudden? Because it was all of a sudden, it was over. They built, and they stopped. Now, that would be, I don't know, what could be comparable in the modern day United States, in the modern world? I mean, the closest, you know, the colossal constructions that we have today would be skyscrapers. So we live in a time where people around the world, under the influence of Western civilization, you know, are very skyscraper conscious, and they keep on building taller and taller ones. And that's, you know, just a sign of the global economy. It's a sign of the way that society works today. It's a fascinating feature of our modern society, that wherever you look, people are building skyscrapers. Okay, imagine if today, and for the rest of time, not a single other one was built. Right? That would be a huge thing. It would be huge. That would tell you that civilization has radically changed. And I could imagine a number of reasons why something like that might happen. It could be really interesting. We might actually enter into an age in your lifetime where people stop building skyscrapers. Can anybody guess why that might happen? No, and I don't mean some kind of apocalypse, some kind of crazy thing like that. Could you imagine a historical process that might lead to us abandoning that most characteristic architectural form of the modern world? I don't know, just talking now about culture and history. Can you guys think of a reason why we might do that? Theo, you want to speculate?
Well, maybe we run out of some material.
That wouldn't happen. No, we're not running out of stuff. Keen, go ahead.
I think if radical Islam were able to sufficiently terrorize the West in order
No, that's not going to happen either. Those guys don't have what it takes to stop that from happening. Cliff?
Well, maybe we think that it's a waste of money or that our resources are better spent on something else.
Well, okay. All right, that's an interesting, more plausible answer, I think. Here's my answer, which is a more positive take on it than what you guys are saying. My answer is, if we develop the flying car, and a lot of people are working on this problem, if we develop the flying car, then what do we need, and maybe even hypersonic travel and various forms of really, really great traveling over great distances? What do we need the cities for that we have now, which are such, see, the cities now, I mean, are such concentrated places, right? Like New York, Manhattan, and every city center is this concentrated place. Why? Because it just makes sense. You get a lot of people living in a certain area, and then you have a core where they all go to work, and that's a high density location, and you want it to be tall because for a variety of practical reasons and a variety of aesthetic reasons. So the cities just ended up being like this, and it makes sense. But imagine if we all were able to fly our cars into work. So imagine we could all be, you know, the distance that we would travel to work would all be like 100 times greater than what it is today. There's no congestion, no traffic jams, no highways, none of that. And we all fly to work. Well, imagine how freeing that will be, right? And why would we need to build skyscrapers anymore? Because basically, you know, your corporate headquarters now is going to be in a beautiful forest somewhere that is, you know, an idyllic setting, and it can be in the middle of the United States, and everybody living all over the country flies to work and gets there really quickly and easily. So why does it have to be in the center of the city anymore, right? The whole kind of necessity of living in a certain mode changes. So anyway, that's my prediction, is that I think if that really takes off, literally, figuratively, if we get flying cars, we might not have skyscrapers anymore. On the other hand, we might have them, but they might be quite different. They might be all by themselves in a, you know, a certain natural location rather than in a concentrated site. Or there could be all kinds of different architectural ramifications of the development of the flying car, let alone space travel, right? And we're already getting to the point where people telecommute, right? I mean, a lot of people work at home. A lot of people, just because of the internet, don't have to commute. I don't, right? So I teach on the internet, so I don't use the highways. And I'm super glad for that. And so that could change the way that, you know, we build things. And that would be a huge change, wouldn't it, right? That would be that the fact that we would abandon one mode of construction for a whole other approach would be a reflection of a radical transformation of our society. We would become a flying society, right? And therefore, we wouldn't need to build in certain ways anymore. That would be amazing. So anyway, just me blabbing about interesting ideas. But the point here being, right, that the stoppage of pyramid building was hugely significant. Why would people stop doing something like that? It meant the world to them, literally. It was the universe explained. Pyramid construction was the way that society functioned. You know, and it didn't function well, but it certainly didn't lead to the flourishing of human beings. But it was better than being nomads. It was better than some alternatives. But then they abandoned it. Huh? That tells us life changed in a big, big way. All right. So anyway, moving on here, because whoa, we got caught up there. Mr. Powell got caught up. Number 11, what was Tutankhamun's original name? Why was it changed? Why is his story so well known compared to those of hundreds and hundreds of other pharaohs, Cliff?
Tutankhamun's original name was Tutankhaten. His dad, Amenhotep, attempted to reform the religion of Egypt and change his name to Akhetaten for his religious reforms. When his father passed away and Tut became pharaoh, the religious reforms of Amenhotep were forgotten, and Tut's name was changed back to match the classic religion.
Okay, great, which is a perfect answer for the first two questions. Ha! However, you didn't answer the third one. We're getting a theme here today that people are forgetting to answer the whole question. Nemo, go ahead.
Oh, Tutankhamun's original name was Tutankhaten. It was changed when his father, Akhenaten's, I don't know how to pronounce all these names. Akhenaten's religious beliefs were abandoned. His father stopped worshipping Egyptian gods except for the sun god Aten. So he named his son Tutankhaten. He even converted his original name from Amenhotep to whatever that name is.
Okay, Akhenaten. Alright, but you're kind of getting off track here, because I'm not asking you why did Akhenaten change his name. So here we need, it was changed from Tutankhaten to Tutankhamun because the religious reforms of Akhenaten were abandoned. But now all I need, Nemo, have you got the third part of the question?
Yes, I have. When his new religion was abandoned, his son's name was changed to Tutankhamun. When historians dug up his tomb, it was untouched by tomb robbers, which enabled historians to delve deeper into Egyptian history.
Okay, not bad. You're on the right track for the third part, but not quite. So the third part, what I would want to see here is, his story is so well known because of the discovery of his intact tomb by Howard Carter in 1922, including, of course, his spectacular golden death mask, which inspired people to know his story. Okay, so because of that anchor fact of history, the discovery of King Tut's tomb, that's why he's so well known. Okay, that's what did it. Right? That's why we're going to continue to focus on that anchor fact of 1922. Because otherwise King Tut would just be another pharaoh. I mean, not quite, right? Because of this religious reformation, this attempted reformation of his father, he's never going to be just another pharaoh. But we still wouldn't be that interested in it if it weren't for that amazing death mask. Okay, number 12. Why did ancient Mesopotamian culture disappear? How was its history revived? Sophie.
The Mesopotamian people did not build structures that would outlast time like the pyramids. Only parts of religious temples called ziggurats remain. The Mesopotamians also did not respect the history before Islam, because the religion states that history before Islam is trivial and doesn't matter. When Napoleon passed through Mesopotamia on his way to invade Egypt, one of his officers, Henry Rawlinson, decoded the Behistun inscription written on the side of a mountain. This inscription provided historians with more critical information about Mesopotamian history.
Okay, there's some good stuff and there's some confusion in there. So, Napoleon did not go to Mesopotamia. So geographically, if you look at that, Egypt is much closer to France than Mesopotamia. He never got further than Egypt. Then he went back to France. Henry Rawlinson is British. So if you go back in your class notes, you'll see that the British went to Mesopotamia because Napoleon had gone to Egypt. So they were scared. They didn't want Napoleon or somebody like him to be able to attack India. So they went to Mesopotamia to forge alliances. So Henry Rawlinson was British. Napoleon was French. So we got to make sure we're clear on that story. Okay, the rest was good. Okay, the rest was good. Timothy, what's your version?
Okay. Ancient Mesopotamian culture disappeared because the Muslims that succeeded the Mesopotamians believed that nothing was important before the religion of Islam, which was formed after Mesopotamia fell. It was revived, however, by a man named Henry Rawlinson. He discovered a carving on a mountain called called the Behistun inscription. It has three languages on it: Old Persian, Elamite, and Akkadian. Since historians at the time knew Old Persian, it was only a matter of time before Rawlinson deciphered the other two languages in 1843. Now that historians understood the languages, they could understand the story of Mesopotamia.
Okay, good. Right. I would just be a little bit careful about overstating the role of Rawlinson, in the sense that the way that you wrote it kind of says, well, Rawlinson did the whole thing single-handedly. I have no problem giving credit to Rawlinson for deciphering the Behistun inscription, but he didn't thereby revive all of Mesopotamian history. All right, so there's a whole science called Assyriology dedicated to that, and a lot of people working on it. So we have to kind of, accept that it is a collective endeavor of the experts in that subject matter, okay? So that is related to number 13. What were the first kingdoms of Mesopotamia called? Why isn't Mesopotamian history named after them? Nemo.
The first kingdoms of Mesopotamia were called Sumer and Akkad. Mesopotamian history wasn't named after these kingdoms. Because of its connection to the Christian Bible, Assyria was the best Mesopotamian archaic past was studied. I think I read that a little bit wrong.
Okay, you want to try again?
The subject of Mesopotamian history became known as Assyriology.
Okay, right. So because of the connection to the Christian Bible, it's Assyria that was the best known. I think that you just missed the word known. It was the best known empire, ancient empire of Mesopotamia. And thus, Mesopotamian history became known as Assyriology. Okay, good. So, 14, what was the Code of Hammurabi? Why is it an anchor fact of history? We already quickly talked about that. Nemo, let's see, well, we gotta have other people. Theo, go ahead.
The Code of Hammurabi was an ancient set of laws known to be very harsh. The reason that they are an anchor fact is that the laws are some of the first recorded laws, along with being a valuable connection to ancient Mesopotamia.
Okay, good, right. And number 15, what was the Persian formula for empire? Empire equals MC squared. Cliff, go ahead.
Well, the leader of the Persian Empire, Sirius, his formula for an empire was to give no reason for the people within his empire to rebel. He let the people within his empire keep their local religion and authorities. So some commoners may not even be aware that they had been conquered.
Okay, so that would be the most important ingredient in the formula, but not the entire formula. So the way that I would characterize that, Cliff, is I would say the Persian emperors were very focused on preventing rebellions. I wouldn't necessarily say they were focused on not giving people a reason to rebel. That's the religious toleration part of it. But they wanted to prevent rebellions. But they understood, for instance, that the formula included local rulers. They're always going to be tempted to rebel. So how do you stop that? Well, you got to have your formula go beyond just, it's the carrot and the stick, right? So you got to have the stick as well when it comes to the satraps. So in this formula, we need the satrapies, but in it, we also need the king's ear. And to supplement the king's ear, we need the king's eye and a system of roads. And we need a bureaucracy to control the empire. Okay, so the formula's got to have religious toleration, and it's got to have the complex bureaucracy to order the system, which consists of satrapies, roads, king's ear, king's eye. Okay, so make sure you get it all in there in a synopsis. All right, and finally, what device was used to determine the level of taxes? Nemo?
Nilometer.
Uh-huh, and what were local rulers called in ancient Egypt, Abby?
Nomarchs.
Okay, and what were the giant structures of Mesopotamia and Persia called, Sophie?
Ziggurats.
Okay, well, all right, good work. Few challenges involved there, but that's exactly what test preparation is for, to iron out some of these difficulties. So I think that was a good and productive exercise. So the test preparation sheet, the tests themselves will be posted to the class webpage, of course. And so look for those, and hopefully you'll be able to do that this weekend. And we'll move on to the subject of ancient Greece next week. Nemo, last question or comment?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Put your hand down then. All right. So, thanks, everybody. Good effort. All right. Have a good weekend, and bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.